Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Wagon Wheel, the podcast where we answer your questions on cricket. Maybe you can support us by doing a super chat if you're in the YouTube with us now, or you can support us by Patreon, which is patreon.com/goodareaspodcast, like MF Jim has. And he's asked a question, which is, following on from my Australia versus Ireland question last week, could Ireland or the Dutch or the Scottish position themselves similar to Abu Dhabi or the UAE have as a preparation spot for teams touring England? Or is it getting proper warm-up pitches less of an issue due to counties being more independent from the ECB? Didn't want Wales to be left out of that here. Okay, so the original plan of Irish cricket was to become the New Zealand of modern-day cricket. So in the old days, teams would go to New Zealand before a tour to Australia and prepare, or just sometimes it would be tacked on to the end as well. But the idea was, if you're going all that way to Australia, you might as well play New Zealand as well. That was Ireland's big plan. The problem that Ireland have is that putting the facilities together for a game costs them money because they don't actually have a ground, right? Like Malahide is a club ground that they have to build up. So it works a little bit better for the Grange. I think the problem with the Dutch is, I could be wrong, I don't know if this is still the case, but I know some teams have complained about the training facilities and other things involved with that. You've still got to put the players up at five-star hotels, you know, it's all that sort of stuff that can be a bit of a problem for these smaller places. Also, the Dutch and the Scottish have been preparing for, you know, List A cricket and One Day cricket and T20 cricket. They're not as good at the other formats. And so, again, you're sort of in that. I think Ireland's plan in the future, though, is definitely to be in a situation where a team will come over to play England and they might warm up with a test match against Ireland or even two of them. And we have seen that before. Rudra says, how good or bad was Ashok Dinta? My grandfather used to complain a lot about how much he hated his bowling action and how he thought he was terrible. However, he's definitely somewhat old-fashioned in his cricket opinions. Also, while I didn't rate Dinta much as a kid, I can't completely trust his stance on Dinta. Ashok Dinta is a really interesting one. Look, obviously, he had decent amount of natural pace. You know, he got the ball through okay. I don't think he was probably... I just think he was probably a prospect when he played at international level. I'm just trying to see if we got any of his... I was trying to see if we got any of his later records. Where did he end up playing at the end? Was it? So in the IPL, he took 69 wickets at 30 at 8.2. I mean, it's not horrendous. It's a good sort of fringe Indian level bowling talent. But yeah, I just felt that he was one of those players who had the natural tools, but not really. I don't know what his main international or elite skill was going to be, Rudra. Like, I don't know what. He wasn't quite fast enough to be fast. He wasn't particularly accurate. He wasn't particularly skillful. It wasn't always the most repeatable action either. He probably was just missing one other key skill that unfortunately never developed. But that's why he played international cricket when he was young, because, you know, he had the athleticism and he had the pace. Ben says, Michael Holding's great quote at the start of Death of Gentlemen seems relevant at the moment. Do you know if the ICC are worried about the recent events in the BPL in Abu Dhabi, bringing the sport into disrepute? Why aren't we hearing more noise about what they'll do to fix it? So, the ICC are obviously aware of my piece on the BPL, and, you know, there's been other reporting as well since my piece came out. The T10 League is definitely something that people within the ICC are concerned about, or T10 leagues in general, I should say, are things that people are a bit concerned about, because they do feel that there has been more instances of anomalies. The problem is that the ICC don't actually run either of those leagues. They're not paid to be the people in charge of them, which is also one of the issues, I think, at the moment. I wonder if going ahead, the only way to get one of these leagues is, like, the ICC needs to put a rule on that says, if you're anyone can host a league, here's the way to host the league, but you actually have to have ICC, ECSU staff available on the ground and reporting back. My issue is that, like, some of these players that were played in the BPL and in the T10 are going to go on to play in ICC events later on. And so you can't just pretend, you can't just say, well, we're not involved in that. So we know it's happening and it's a bit of a problem, but we'll worry about it later. You have to worry about it as it happens. And that's been my issue, and you know, I've talked to them a bit about this before, of this idea that we're not in charge of that tournament, doesn't matter. But that kind of comes back, Ben, to the major theme of my last 3 or 4 years of work. The ICC isn't really in charge of cricket. So there's not much they can do to actually change anything here. They're not looking into that. But I am working on a piece that I think can go beyond. I don't think the ICC now should ever be hiding behind the fact that they are not the official agents of, or the official anti-corruption unit of any of these tournaments. And I also don't think that they need to anymore, because it's not like the old days. You don't need someone on the ground the whole time. There are now betting anomalies that we can follow up. We have video, we have statistical things to back it up on. You could say any player in the world should be, the ICC should be able to ban any player in the world. And I've been watching the NBA is really interesting, and in what they've been doing of recent times with, I think it's, is it Terry Rozier and obviously Jonte Porter? You know, they are using betting anomalies and weird patterns to confront players. The ICC could do that if it's in a T10 league or if it's in the BPL. There's nothing stopping them. Nicholas says, did England miss a trick with Ed Joyce? As a consistent brilliant county cricketer, a very good but slightly old-fashioned one-day cricketer, and an outright prehistoric T20 cricketer. They only ever picked him in ODIs and T20s. Obviously, it was harder to break into England's test lineup through 2006 to 2012. Players with similar or inferior county records got a lot more opportunity in this era. I think it's crazy that the Dublin-born batter in that era that played 16 tests for England was Owen Morgan, not Ed Joyce. Ed Joyce is really interesting. I played with Ed when he was about 17 or 18 in club cricket in Melbourne. And I've played with other people. I would say I've played with about 10 or 15 younger players who are much more naturally gifted than Ed Joyce and never got anywhere near the top level. His ability to get better, to understand the game, to read situations was really quite special, I think. Because even though he was talented, I don't think he was talented on the level, you know. We had other players at our club that had seemingly had more time than him, had better techniques than him and everything. The fact that he ended up getting to the level he did, I think really shows the kind of person he was. So he could have done well in test cricket as well. I think he's probably like a fringe international level player though, Nicholas. So those sorts of players, you almost need luck to go your way. The fact he still played international cricket for England, and so I don't think there was an issue there. But your point about Owen Morgan is fine. I think what they would have said is, and you know, I can't remember who the selectors were at that time, but I think what they would have said is that Owen Morgan's ceiling is much higher than Ed Joyce's ceiling, so it's worth taking a punt. If you go back and have a look at my writing at that time, I was like, Owen Morgan will never make runs in test cricket. It's impossible with his technique and the way he bats. He's never made runs consistently in first-class cricket. It's not going to happen in test cricket. But I don't think if you'd said to me, oh, Ed Joyce is a player worth taking a gamble on, I would have gone with that either. Bloody says, you have mentioned before that the 90s to 2000s was unique in test cricket for having relatively even parity between teams. How much of this is because of the flatter wickets back then? 2000s especially had absolute roads. Of course, flatter wickets means more draws, but it also allow for more upsets. I think it was probably also just a bit of a fluke, Bloody. Like if you had teams like India and Pakistan and New Zealand and Sri Lanka, I suppose, if you want to put them in there as well, who had never really been good before that period, and they all started to get good at that time. And then you had Australia was on the rise. The West Indies were still a good side. You know, so there was quite a few good teams in that period of time. As professionalism is coming in, it's kind of before the Australian professionalism completely changes everything, and then England and India sort of follow suit, right? So it's right at that period before where I think you would have to say, like, natural talent-wise, there are plenty of countries with good natural talent. The difference is when you have the money to be able to back that up and everything else. So the 90s weren't flat wickets, and that was still a pretty even competition. The 2000s probably allowed for weaker sides to draw more, I would have thought at times. But yeah, no, I don't think the pitchers played a big part in that. Rudra says, India's 2013 Champions Trophy Final 11 was Rohit Dhawan, Kohli, Dinesh Karthik, Raina, Dhoni, Jadeja, Ashwin, Bhuvi, Ishan. I don't know why I read all this out. It was all those players. How well would that team do in this Champions Trophy? How do they compare to some of the current teams? It depends on how they play. If they play the way they did back then, they wouldn't be really a chance. A little bit worried about the Ishant Umesh bowling. And Are they missing? So they've got Jadeja and they've got Ashwin. So they've got 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. They don't, probably they're missing an all-rounder. I don't think they do particularly well now. Talent-wise, I don't think they'd have an issue, but they probably have to change their lineup a little bit to be successful now. But if you look at their team compared to Bangladesh, Pakistan, probably New Zealand, they probably play a similar version of cricket to what those other teams are still playing. So I just don't think they'd be at the upper echelon, though. Adityan says, I remember you saying that you're not your club's captain. If the team decides to make you play, wouldn't it just make sense to let you captain as well and use your tactical skill? Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much club cricket you played, Adityan, but captaining a club side, especially in England, is mostly just calling people up and hoping that they're available to play. I just don't have the time to do that. And I don't play every game. So I would say that it is, I would say that at times it's a bit hard because I would probably only play like, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 games a year. And so it means that the other captain is captaining the other half. It depends on how that other person feels. It also depends on the other person. Look, I'd be lying if I said that it wasn't an issue at some stages, because there are things about the game that I could see that a club player cannot see. And also, sometimes they're just doing things that are a little bit out of date, right? And like, no, we don't have to do this, we could do this. And so that can cause some issues. Club captains, though, know club cricket really well. They've played a lot more lower level club cricket than I have quite often. Yeah, and it just depends on the leader. I've played with some captains who have just sort of let me go, if that makes sense. And so they still captain the side, and I sort of, I'll be a vice captain in a sort of Rahane or Shane Warne type of way, where I'm just, you know, if I come over with an idea, unless they massively disagree with it, they'll back it up. I wouldn't mind, like, maybe one day captaining a side again from beginning to end. But the extra work around it, I just don't know if I'll, and especially during cricket season. Like this year, I'll be at like 6 or 7 test matches. That doesn't give me a lot of time to be around. But yeah, I suppose where I get frustrated is where I don't mind them disagreeing with me, but I would prefer that some captains listen to me. And that hasn't been the case. But I had real issues with the captain when I played at Barnes, which is my first club. To the point at which I refused to play in his side anymore. I just said, I just want to go down a level. And when I was asked, I just said, I can't be in an environment where someone who has played a fraction of the amount of cricket that I've played won't listen to me. Right. And it was more about the listening. If he listened and went, no, whereas he was just like, he didn't want to be involved in the conversation. And I've certainly had arguments with other captains, you know, at times again, where it's like, I'll make a really small tweak to the field that doesn't really change anything from their perspective. And they want me to run everything by them. And I'm like, let's say I'm fielding at cover and they're fielding at deep mid wicket. I can't tell them why I'm making that change in the middle of the over because the batter will hear, right? And I remember there was one in a game last year where I only wanted to change the field by a small amount. And I was trying to do something. And the captain was like, oh, tell me why you're doing it. I'm like, I can't tell you why I'm doing it. Like, because you're too far away. So, you know, there are little things like that. But, I mean, that's just part of it. And to be honest, you know, even when I was in official leadership positions, that's just part of cricket. So, you know, I don't think I should ever be the only tactician on the field. And I've played in games of that where they're just like, we're not going to make any decisions because you're out here. And I'm like, well, that's not how it works, right? Like, if I'm playing a game with professional cricketers, I'm still going to suggest things to them. And as I said before, club cricket is no club cricket is better, right? So there is an element of all that. Ben says, if when a former player involved in the Sandpaper Gate incident is given enough money by a publisher for a tell-all biography, which confirms, as I think we all assume, that the bowlers, of course, knew about the tampering. Well, Cameron Bancroft has already said that, but yeah, sure. Will it affect the legacy of some pretty great bowlers? Stark, Hazelwood, Cummins, Lyon would all be implicated. Does the impact on their legacy change if they've already retired by that point? There's not a bowler in the world who's not tempered with the ball, especially in the reverse swing era, but even in the era before that, it's just a part of the game. Will it affect their legacy? I suppose. I mean, does it affect Wasim Akram and Waqar Yunus' legacy? Does it affect Dale Steyn's legacy? Like, do you think Dale Steyn didn't know why the South Africans were always tampering with the ball when he was playing? So I suppose it depends. Look, there are some people that are always looking for that sort of stuff. I think anyone who knows anything about cricket would already knows that these guys were at the very least involved in it. I think they were more than involved in it too. I think from what I've heard on the ground, it was a bowler who was upset that the ball had stopped or wasn't reversing when they had prepared it. And I can't remember the full story, but I think there was some dampness or so they had prepared the ball to reverse. Everyone thought it was going to reverse. Then there was a little bit of moisture around. It wasn't reversing. And then he said, we have to get this to reverse. And that's probably why Cameron Bancroft went and did it, because that's not the way that they were doing it. That's why they weren't getting caught, right? That's the story as I understand it from putting it together from all the different pieces. But yeah, I suppose it changes their legacy. It's funny, isn't it? Like Mike Atherton, Faf du Plessis, does it change their legacy? Like, that's what I mean. There's so many. Vernon Philander was another one. Sachin Tendulkar was charged and found guilty, and I know he ended up being overturned. But I'm sure Sachin Tendulkar tampered with the ball at times. Do you know why? Almost every cricketer I've ever played with has mucked around with the ball at one stage or another. And the only ones who didn't were the ones who didn't know to do it. It's a very normal thing, picking at the seam, keeping one side shiny, roughing up the other side, banging it into the ground. If people start slogging, hammering the ball into the ground. This is just a normal thing that cricketers do. So, you know, perhaps for some people it will change how they think about them. But I already assume that they were involved in that. And I don't really see, you know, once Cameron Bancroft came out and said it, that's kind of it, isn't it, at that point? Anyway, we'll take a quick break and we'll be back with more on the Wagon Wheel. A few years ago, I realized that trying to find the best stories in cricket was impossible for any fan. I even tried to get funding to make my own cricket Huffington Post. It never quite worked. But luckily, we finally have someone filling this massive void in our game, Best of Cricket. They scour the publications everywhere to find, quite simply, all the best news and the greatest stories on our sport. Then they make it just as easy. They either email it or WhatsApp it direct to you. Cricket's greatest tales delivered to your device. This is truly the best of cricket. Ian says, with Dhoni as a very notable exception, why do you think there have been such small number of permanent wicketkeeper captains in international cricket? They would have the best view of what a pitch or any particular bowler is doing. Or is it just a workload issue? Partly, and you're not going to be shocked, Ian, when I say this, it comes back to class. Again, wicketkeepers were generally professionals. So there is an element of the class factor in the traditional style of cricket. But there is also a very strong theory in cricket that if you are wicketkeeping, it's such a tired and full-on job when you're in the field, that you don't really have the mental space or freshness to be able to make decisions. I think Dhoni has obviously proved that's incorrect, and so have many other captains. We see it in first-class cricket all the time. So we're probably moving beyond it, but I think that's probably a big part of it. It's just that there is that hang on. I mean, I reckon I wrote a piece, 2008, 2009, dispelling this. It just didn't make any sense then, and it doesn't now. So in the future, we'll probably see more bowlers and more keepers, would be my guess. Jane says, this is going to sound insane. Awesome, good start. But is Kumar Sangakkara possibly underrated as a test batter? He scored 12,000 runs at 57. Both home and away averages are comfortably above 50. Even considering that he played in a batter-friendly era, his career match factor is scarcely believable, 1.47. And finally, considering that about 3,000 of his runs were scored as a wicketkeeper, it sure seems we've got a top five batter of all time. Why isn't he talked about in the same breath as Tendulkar, Hobbs, Lara? Where's the blemish? One of the issues with Kumar Sangakkara is not his fault. It's the percentage of runs he scored, I want to say outside of Asia. It's not quite as bad as Mahela's numbers, but I think it's very similar. So a lot of his runs are very, very one-dimensional. Not that he had, you know, he played some great innings in Australia. I think he made runs in New Zealand, so I'm just bringing up the record. Yeah, made runs in South Africa, was okay in England. So overall, there's no real blemish. But I think I'm right in saying, so he makes 9,300 of those 12,000 runs in Asia. And the only place he scores over 1,000 runs anywhere else is Australia. I think that is held against him. It's not particularly his fault, of course. I think that's held against him a little bit, and he's seen more as a one-dimensional player. But his record goes up altogether. I think you do have to factor in though, Jane, that that batting was majorly was in the great batting era. He doesn't have like really any overlap on either side of it. Yeah, I think he's got a fair case to be. I can't remember how high. So we the way that we looked at it for the Art of Batting book is we had them in like ranges. I think his range is roughly where you've got these other guys. Not Tendulkar, but certainly where you've got Hobbs and Lara. Sorry, not Hobbs. Where you've got Lara and Hutton and Gavaskar and Smith. I've got him in that kind of range. But I think he ends up a little bit lower overall. I don't know if Varun is just slandering Prosper Utsaya here. What was Prosper Utsaya's test record? But yeah, I think if you look... So I think if you look at it, all things considered, he's probably, he's not top three or top four worthy, but he's probably in that sort of callous mode of then where you just want to fit him in. I don't know, maybe a top, maybe as high as four or five, and then maybe as low as 12. And then it's all about personal preference. The wicket-keeping one's quite interesting, Jane, because... The more I look into it, the less I think wicket-keeping has a huge effect on test batting. AB de Villiers, I think, has the best average of a wicket-keeper ever. And the reason he has a really high average compared to Walcott or Kumar, so two of the other great batters, is because he wicket-keeps in his prime and they wicket-keep when they're still on their way up. And so I wonder if there isn't an element there of we actually think wicket-keeping is worse. Where Kumar Sangakkara, when I chatted to him, it's in the interview, he kind of talks about it as something he wanted to keep doing. So I think that sort of shows you that perhaps it's not quite the millstone around your neck. But yeah, I think Kumar's a very good conversation to be had for the top 10 of all time. I'd have to go through all the different notes. But yeah, he's a very good conversation for that. I don't think he's like top three or top four, though. I think he's a step below those kinds of other players. MF Jim says, who should be swapped out for... actually, just one last thing on the Kumar thing. So at a certain point, right, you also have to say who he's better than. I don't think you can make a claim that he's had a better career than Tendulkar or Hobbs. Kumar himself talked about how Lara was a better player than him. And Lara had skills that Kumar didn't have. I'm not saying that makes it automatic. But when you say, where's the blemish? It's not about blemish. Guys in the top 10 don't really have blemishes, right? Like, that's why they're in the top 10. And so it's easy to go, like, that was the thing with Ricky Ponting the other day. It's like, oh, Josh Ellis is underrated. Okay, so who would you have him above on the list? And when you start to talk to the guys, they start to push Callis and Kumar down a little bit, right? And I'm talking about how the top batters talk about these players. So... Again, I don't think that means either of them are not great. It just means that there's probably, I'd have to go back in our list. You can make a claim that there's probably between 14 and 18 kind of all-time great batters. And these are indisputable. And then there's about another, I think it's another 19 or 20 that are obviously, again, great batters without any questions, right? They might have issues within their... They might have some blemishes, but they're still great batters, unquestionably. So you have 20 people or 18 people right at the top, and then another 20 below them at that sort of top level who are automatically great. And it would be very hard to argue against any of those players as great. But where you put them does come down to what you rate higher and everything else. And it's easy to say, look at Kumar Sangakkara, what a record he had, and then look at Herbert Sutcliffe and say the exact same thing. And that's the issue, I think, that you start to get to. You're nitpicking between levels of greatness, and they're both great. MF Jim says, who should be swapped out for Sri Lanka at the Champions Trophy, Australia or England? England, that's easy. Rob says, I phrased my question on no balls last week poorly. Trying again. To reduce the risk of a no ball, why don't coaches insist that bowlers land with their front foot further back, i.e. have their toes behind the crease, rather than the heel in the crease? The risk and penalties of a no ball seems higher than bowling a very slightly slower delivery. It's not as simple as that. I've seen people involved with long jump try and fix no balls before, and it's not as simple as that. In fact, My dad always had a theory, and he didn't bowl a lot of no balls, that if he was bowling no balls, he would actually make his run up shorter. And he would make his run up shorter by about a foot, because that would change his stride pattern. And by changing his stride pattern, he would usually just come behind the line naturally. And I know there are some test bowlers who think the exact same thing as my old man. So it's not as random a theory as you might think. Most people obviously move it back. The problem is, in either direction, once you're changing your stride pattern, Rob, once you're changing your normal run-up, you are changing your stride pattern one way or another. And you naturally fill it in. And so I don't think it's as simple. No, it's not as simple as you think to be able to do that automatically. Now, should fast bowlers be more like long jumpers and be able to do that? Sure. But long jumpers actually still go massively over the line sometimes, right? And so I do think there is an element of, it is very hard. If I told you, Rob, to take 10 paces right now, and then I closed, and then I put a blindfold around your head and told you to take another 10 paces, you're probably not going to be in the exact same position. And I suppose that's the thing that is hard to overcome. Now, there might be disciplines in other places outside of long jump that cricket can look, but that's the one that I've heard of the most. Shyam says, what do you make of the most recent Ranatunga comment? If we consider players from both sides were at their peaks, can that Sri Lanka team still defeat this Indian side? I don't know anything about Ranatunga's comments. I don't pay a lot of attention to former players' comments. And it's not because I'm like, oh, Ranatunga's an idiot or anything. I'm just like, how much time does he actually spend watching cricket now? Do you know what I mean? So most of the time when you get a comment by a former player, I'll respect it if I know that former player has done the work. Outside of that, they're just saying things. Adityan says, can you talk more about Morgan's funky fields for Plunkett? Why was it different from the traditional umbrella field that everyone sets for short pitch bowling? How about fields for Adil Rashid? Well, back when Morgan started with those fields, we didn't actually have them that often. So even New Zealand, who would sometimes, with Lockie Ferguson, would bowl short, they didn't really go in with the full length, variation of it. So if you go back before 2015, bouncers were a surprise delivery. And unless you were bowling against someone like, I don't know, Rayner or Ganguly or Michael Bevan occasionally, I don't think you ever went short that much, right? And some of it was about the amount of bounces you could bowl and all these sorts of different things. What happens with Plunkett is that they realize that because of Plunkett's height and his pace and his ability to get inconsistency from the surface because of his strength, that they can set a field with sometimes four fielders on the leg side, right? And then eventually, I think it was three fielders on the leg side, obviously, with when fielding changes changed and everything else. And the idea was that it was very hard to flat bat Plunkett back over his head. And you could have fine leg out, deep backward square out, and deep mid wicket out, mid on and mid off up in the circle, and then a deep third if you got a mistake. And I think sometimes they had a deep point as well. And he was going to angle the ball back in, and he was going to be able to do that. That wasn't really how bowlers had bowled before. Yorkers were much more important. Slow balls were much more important. Plunkett does bowl slower balls, but even then, they're into the wicket and at the body again, right? Like, everything was sort of at your hip or at your chest. Certainly where he was trying to bowl, he wasn't always the most accurate, but that's certainly what he was trying to do. And so they took that idea from little bits. I think it was Lockie Ferguson. This is where you'd have to interview all the different people involved, but my memory was analysts were involved and also watching Lockie Ferguson, McCullum, and New Zealand handle Lockie Ferguson. And it wasn't just Lockie Ferguson, there was someone else before him as well. And they sort of came up with that and they were like, okay, so it's a risky shot playing the pull shot and the hook shot consistently. If we could do that, can we force people into chipping their wickets away? And Plunkett was a really expensive bowler. Like, I've looked back at the numbers. He was a really expensive bowler, but he consistently got wickets at a time when most people didn't. And it meant that you couldn't just cruise against England in the middle overs. Rashid, I mean, I suppose they would, you know, in the sort of Brendan McCullum, Kyron Pollard, MS Dhoni way, they would sometimes have attacking fielders later on. I don't remember anything massively funky about Rashid's fields off the top of my head, but I'd have to go back through notes. Amit says, saw your recent video about several iterations of Bazball in which you say that New Zealand winning World Test Championship is a Bazball story. Do you think New Zealand were deserving winners, or were they lucky because of COVID, due to which their home series got points? Extra lap. I can't even say that word. I had a feeling New Zealand were a good test side during that time, but not better than India and Australia. Okay. They won the game when they had to. I mean, isn't that the deal? Do you think the best team always wins the Cricket World Cup or the Champions Trophy? No. You win when you have to win. Sometimes things go in your favour. I've seen Australia be lucky. I've seen the West Indies be lucky. I've seen England be lucky. That's cricket. That's sport. If you really want to know who the best team is, you wouldn't play a one-off test match for the final. Joe says, if an all-time 11 of off-spinners, all with reasonable amount of wickets, so Gale, Clark could qualify. Well, Clark's not an off-spinner, so do you mean finger spinners? Played an all-time leg spinner 11, who would win? My biased money is on the leggies. So who would you have? You'd have Bob Simpson, Aubrey Faulkner, Richie Beno, Rashid Khan, Inter Kabalam? Where would he bat? Probably lower down. I think the leggies batting would be quite low, Joe, wouldn't it? Whereas you could open, if you're counting Gale, and you've got Gale, Jay Saria, I don't know how many wickets someone like Mark Waugh got. Michael Clark, if he counts in your spectrum, does Sachin count? Which side does Sachin play for? He probably has to be the off-spin side, doesn't he? Hooper, Root. Feels to me like it would be the off-spinners over the leg spinners. But that's a great question. I think I'd have to go into it quite a bit. MF Jim says, can we get a post-championship trophy rant? This feels like the most nothing tournament off the back of so many World Cups. Yeah, I think the issue with the Champions Trophy is there are ways to make it better and there are ways for it to work. I don't think ignoring it and forgetting you have it is a good start. So there are clear issues within the tournament, but it could work. But if you're playing so many other tournaments, and it's not just men's cricket anymore. It's women's cricket. Like the WPL is on now, but also there's a Women's World Cup this year. There's so much cricket on now that everything feels a little bit devalued. And so a tournament that is already devalued, worse, even worse. Let's have another quick break here on the Wagon Wheel. And coming up next, more of your questions. And that is why Australia decided to drop Shane Keith Warne. Cricket is a game of strategy, of picking the right players for the right moment, or playing the right shots at the right ball. And Hit Wicket captures that perfectly. In Hit Wicket, you're not just picking a team, you're collecting cricket legends, expanding your squad with each new addition. The more players you have, the more options you have to dominate in any situation. And then comes the real challenge, picking your playing 11. Who are your opener, run machine, and Mr. 360? Do you stack your top order with aggressive batters, or do you build a solid foundation? And what about your bowling attack? Do you go with pace, spin, a mixture of both? We've got the Tasmanian Devil, Jimmy, and Boom. The possibility are endless. The beauty of Hit Wicket is that you need to adapt your lineup to your opponent. They can be powerful, balanced, and technical. Each class has an edge over another. It's a tactical dance where you need to anticipate your opponent's moves and exploit their weaknesses. So if you think you've got the strategic mind to build a championship team, download Hit Wicket and prove it. All right, welcome back. Didier said, where would you play Sachin and Steve Smith in the all-time problem solvers list? Is there any chance that Smith gets above Tendulkar, even though his overall batting is not at the Tendulkar level? I think his overall batting is at the Tendulkar level. I just don't think his career is at that Tendulkar level. I think they're both pretty high, partly just because of the way their careers have worked as well. Maybe there are other players who we would have similarly high, but played... Like, I wonder where Kumar would be, to go back to the question from before, weirdly enough. Because I think Kumar is a very... I think that was one of Kumar's big skills as well. But he played all in one era. And he never had to go up against the wobble ball. He had a little bit of DRS. But I would have loved to have seen more of Kumar in that kind of environment to see... You know, I would have loved for him to play more in the bad bit of the 90s or come through to the wobble ball and see how he would have gone then. Because I think he was a fantastic player as well. Yeah, I think that's a very interesting one. Obviously, I suppose you'd have players like, I think players like Javed Miandad and George Headley would be quite interesting as well. Sunil Gavaskar, I think, would be really high. So there's a few players. Amit says, love your Ponting versus Kohli and Sachin versus Smith video. Just had a question in mind after watching them. In the history of Test cricket, has there ever been a player to make a comeback after a drop in form as Kohli has had? Yeah, heaps of them. I would say, what was Rahul Dravid's 3-year bad period? I don't think anyone's ever had it as long as Kohli. Let's have a look. Rahul Dravid, I say his was 2 years, averaged about 33 in 2007, 2008, over 25 test matches. So it's a lot of test matches. And I think if you go back, not only if you watch him in eye test, but also if you look at their batting averages in those years, he was probably as bad in those years as Kohli's been over a 4-year stretch. Has anyone ever been as bad as Kohli over a 4-year stretch? I suppose it wasn't in a row though with Kohli. I was about to say, no, I don't think anyone could have done it 4 years in a row. But I don't think Kohli's is 4 years in a row because he has one good year in the middle. I think if you go back through the history of cricket, you will find more players with as many bad years as Kohli that are still great. I don't think you will see them stacked up in the same way. And then but where do you fit the 1 year where he did make runs in that, Amit? Which I think people have just completely ignored now, right? So let's say he had the 3 bad years of, let me look up his numbers in front of me. It's easier to do it here. And doing it with years is not perfect, but it would be better to do it in rolling 5 test averages or whatever. But we'll do it for years for now. So he averages 19 in 3 tests in 2020. So there's really nothing. He averages 28. So let's call that 26 or 25 over 1 year. He then averages 26 again. So 26 over 2 years. He then averages 55. And he then averages 24.5 again. So that's pretty common. What's not common is the low averages, or not as common. But remember that not all the players, like when Rahul Dravid went through his dip, it was at a time where everyone was making more runs. So, you know, Ricky Ponting's dip was when everyone was making more runs. Whereas I think, is it Martin Crowe? There was someone, might have even been Gordon Greenidge, that I was looking at recently. Let's have a look. So Martin Crowe, yeah, his dip's not too bad. Maybe it was Gordon Greenidge. So you do get players like that. But the thing is that, you know, you get players, the only players who go through periods like this are the great players. Like anyone else is just dropped. Amit. And so those players, you get players all the time who go through a run. Like Usman Khawaja has been through a bunch of runs worse than Virat Kohli, right? But he was dropped. And at some stages wasn't even making runs in first class cricket, right? And still managed to come back. So let's have a look at, so Gordon Greenidge averages 37, 38, 28 over his last 3 years. And then he has that 45 at the end. If you look at the last, I think it's about 6 years of Gordon Greenidge, he's got 2 years where he makes runs and 4 years where he doesn't. So do you count that year at the end? Dravid's worst test run was a match factor of 0.42. Jesus Christ. That seems like a video, Varun. Thank you for that. So yes, it has happened. Whether it's happened for as long, probably not, because most players would be dropped, but great players don't. I'm trying to think if there's another great player who just had an awful run. Because you've had things like the Greg Chappell one, right, where he made like 19 duck, 1, 0, 1 duck, 12 or whatever it was. So you've had points like that. You've had players drop off at the end, which is kind of what Kohli's done. And then I suppose like Gordon Greenidge, you could still have a good year at the end, right? Doesn't mean that you can't not bring it back a little bit. Satchmo says, would a South African pace attack consisting of their best three quicks in the 21st century, Steyn, Rabada, Philander, be stronger than the Australian one, McGrath, Cummins, Hazelwood? Steyn, Rabada, Philander, McGrath, Cummins, Hazelwood. I would pick the South African one there, Satchmo. MF Jim says, as a recent graduate of Fans with Laptops, hey, that's my writing course, sports writing course. We've got media stuff and everything. What hat should I toss in the air? My club baggy, a Terry Towling, or a Kimber S cap? Look, when it comes to caps, MF Jim, Decide on the cap that you need and throw it as far as possible. But for those, I get asked all the time, you know, how do I get into the business and how do I learn how to be better as a sports writer? I'm like, I've done the course. It's like, I don't know, $50 or $60. It's up on Teachable. We've added to it a couple of times now in 3 or 4 years. We added to it with the podcast and the video. In a couple of years, I'm sure we'll try and add another layer to it as well. And when I have more bits to put on it, like for someone like MF Jimmy who already has it, there might be more things added in the future. Any cap you want, congratulations. Jumon Lee says, what is that Akash Chopra Shikhar Dhawan beef you keep alluding to? I don't know. It's in Akash Chopra's book. He never says what the beef is, just that they didn't like each other and didn't really talk off the field, if I remember correctly. It's called Beyond the Blue. Is that what it's called? I don't think I have it up here. Somewhere else. So I don't know what it is. I don't know if it still is involved or anything, but it's mentioned at least once in the book, I reckon 2 or 3 times. James says, with more and more people being vegetarian, vegan, do you think cricket balls will move away from being leather in the medium term? I don't know if they'll be leather forever in the same way we're not always going to play on grass pitches, are we? Like, we're already moving towards synthetics there. I would assume that a similar thing will happen with leather balls. The issue, James, is that I'm not an expert, but the issue is at the moment there isn't another thing that degrades properly. So if you change the ball, you are changing the sport more so than pink balls, more so than white balls, more so than day-night cricket, more so than you are really changing the sport if the ball doesn't degrade or degrades quicker or whatever that case may be. So how we find a ball that allows us to keep playing the way we want is the question. But there's almost the pink ball, I still think it's a better ball than the white ball. My research was that it had between, let's say, $1 million and $3.5 million of, I say $5 million, of R&D across MCC, Cricket Australia, Kookaburra, someone else was involved in it at one stage as well. MCC, ICC, yeah. So there's about 4 different groups. No one put a lot of money into it. And that is a potential $1 billion investment when you think about the future of Test cricket. And also making I think the pink ball's better than the white ball. As in full cricket going ahead. And it took them decades to get to that level. You would need someone who I would assume, James, the best case scenario would be someone invents something, it starts to get used, gets picked up in a couple of newspaper articles, and then someone like Kookaburra or Jukes or SG or whatever hears about it and tries it. But yes, I do think this. I mean, it's funny when you say, well, more and more people being vegetarian and vegan. Think about how many vegetarians we've always had in cricket. It's kind of interesting, or as I should say vegans specifically, it's kind of interesting that we haven't got there already. Rob says, what is your tier ranking for Morne Morkel as a player? 309 wickets at 27 is very good, but I feel like he could have achieved more. But perhaps the old commentators corrupting my opinion will always go on about him not pitching the ball up. Tall bowlers, quite often, Rob, don't pitch the ball up because when they pitch the ball up, it's a bit floaty. It's actually very hard for tall bowlers to pitch the ball up. It's why Kyle Jameson's so special, because he has that ability where a lot of tall bowlers don't. He's not like top 50 of all time or anything, Morne Morkel. Definitely a South African great without any question. And on his day was as good as anyone. But I think it's probably fair he did not get the most out of himself as a player. I find it fascinating that he's gone on to be a coach. And I don't know what kind of level of coach he is, but just because he was not, him and his brother were both accused of being natural talents who didn't quite fulfill it, weren't always the most thinking cricketers, and yet both of them have gone on to be pretty successful coaches, I think, at times. So I find that really fascinating. Does that mean we were underestimating them or anyone else? I'm the person who once said that no matter what happens, Morne Morkel takes 4 for 80. Whether he bowls good or he bowls poorly. And I think having those kinds of gifts, he really should have been. And at bowling in South Africa, he probably should have ended up with a bowling average of 22, 23, right? So where do you rate him compared to who's got a bowling average of 27? Mitchell Stark, right? Where do you rate him against someone like that? I'm trying to think of who else. there wouldn't be that many bowlers with Broad's a bit different again, Varun. It's a good call, but because Broad's in a different category because of the 4 million wickets. But I wonder where you would rate Mornay compared to, and this is where I think it's kind of unfair on him. Just trying to find another bowler with a similar kind of record. So test bowlers with around 200. So you've got Shami, Morkel, Stark, Wagner. Okay, so you got Wagner, right? I think we can all agree that Wagner got absolutely the most out of himself, step by step. And we can probably agree that Mornay Morkel just naturally should have had a much better record than someone like Neil Wagner, right? But when it comes down to it, does that mean that Wagner is a better bowler than Mornay Morkel? Like, are we being unfair to Mornay Morkel? He's still taken 300 wickets at 27, right? And that goes back to the Kumar conversation before of how you work these sorts of people out and how you rate them. A lot of it comes down to you. If you were picking a game tomorrow, and they're both very good first change bowlers, by the way. If you're picking a game tomorrow, you probably still pick Mornay Morkel 9 times out of 10 ahead of Wagner, right? But Neil Wagner's ended up with the same record as him. So does that mean he's the better player for getting absolutely everything out of himself to get himself to that record? Or does it mean that Mornay Morkel is poorly treated or better treated? That's why these conversations are kind of endless and circular. They're fascinating, but you can't really come up with an answer. I thought Mornay Morkel was really good at cricket, and I enjoyed all of his 4 for 80s. MF Jim says, have you ever had a media watch moment, either where you've done something that you've had to retract or written about another organization's work? I've written tons of things about other organizations' work. When I came into, I had a very bad reputation within some cricket media. I think it was within Australia when I started, because I would write about cricket journalists and point out mistakes that they made. And they were really, it was not the done thing. It was not what you did at the time. And it's a small community. I kind of understand why they went that way. My thinking was, why is it fair for us to say this cricket has made a mistake, but not to say this cricket writer made a mistake? And aren't we trying to get better as a community? But it didn't always go down well early on. So there were plenty of issues, I think, with that. You know, some of those journalists I'm friends with now, right? And some of them I'll never be friends with. And I think that's fair. Some of the former players don't like me criticizing their comments as well, or, you know, pointing out the logical fallacies within them or the factual fallacies within them. I'm kind of going to say what I say. Like, I suppose my career would be better if I had more of a filter, but I don't. And I kind of try and do that. As far as retract anything, I've never had a piece retracted. I've never had a piece deleted that I'm aware of. I might have deleted pieces on Cricket with Balls, but I don't think it was for they were being factually incorrect. I could be wrong, but I can't remember any. There was probably other reasons. I don't remember anything coming down from Crickinfo. We've had stuff on the video site where they're like, sometimes we'll put up a short video and that short, the clip that we've taken, the rest of the video is right, but the clip, maybe more information has come up. So we've occasionally had to delete stuff because of stuff there. So I suppose that's a form of retraction. I remember writing a piece about Irish cricket. It was like 7,000-8,000 words. And in 8,000 words, they were like, I had to retract something, but I retracted it because it was going to cause an issue for Irish cricket going forward. But it came up and it looked like a retraction. And then there was something else that I'd written that I'd gotten backwards. So there were two mistakes. And I remember this guy going to town on me, and I was like, it's an 8,000 word piece in a normal 8,000 word piece, especially sports writing, where, you know, it's not like you're going through a huge editorial process and you don't have fact checkers working on it. It's not like Americans writing or anything. You're going to have one or two small errors quite regularly. So, I think if you look at our videos, occasionally there are mistakes in those and little things. I don't do full-blown news that often, and all of my news stuff is right. The only thing I would say is that sometimes you get things where you are right, but then new information comes to light afterwards, which kind of makes your piece less important. But yeah, I've never really had that. Media Watch, I was in Private Eye once. What is it? Commentary balls or something they call it, which was I said, it was during the World Cup. I reckon it was 2019 World Cup. And I said on TalkSport, I was doing updates. Whoever it was, Pakistan has won the Pakistan decided to win the toss. That's what I said. Not my best moment. But I misspeak all the time. So there's probably heaps of those. But I don't know how much private eye have ever been involved. And for those that don't know, Media Watch is a really big show in Australia, which is a brilliant show if you want to learn about Australian culture. You can learn about it via journalism, which is very, very interesting. But yeah, I can't think of anything. It's usually you write a big news story. I remember I talked to Cricket Australia for this big news story on an A-team thing where the players were really moaning behind the scenes and they gave me heaps of information. I talked to Pat Howard about it and then we released the story. And then afterwards, someone else from Cricket Australia gave me more information that would have meant I would have rewritten the piece differently. The basic premise was still there, but the piece was wrong. And I did say, well, I got this information from you guys. And so you get that quite a bit. You know, little bits like that where you do all the work and then afterwards they're like, oh, well, if you'd only ask this, and it's like, well, it's very rare I'll write a piece only talking to one person. I talked to three or four people and you can't get all the information. I think you just have to accept that and, you know, it has to be part of how you deal with the job. But because I'm not a news journalist, it's not quite the same as what Nick Holt or, you know, Chris Barrett or George Nobel and the, you know, those people have to do. So it's usually a news piece. I've certainly never had a news piece have an issue, but sometimes I've had a piece that has news in it where I was probably right, but things have gone on a little bit. But as a sports writer, you get things wrong all the time. Not everyone talks to you. And then you've got 11 players on the field. They don't all agree with each other. And even when you get like, I've had stuff from meetings, ICC meetings, where four people have told me stuff. And two other people later, I've got in touch with two new variations of what has happened. Like, you have to accept that as a journalist, that you are going to put it out there. You're going to say it's right. And it's not always going to go exactly the way you want. All right, let's have another quick break here. And then after the break, we will have more of the questions from the room, the super chats, here on the Wagon Wheel. A test happens when you're asleep. Where do you find the best match report? A cricketer's backstory is meticulously crafted by a great writer. But it's a day you're not on social media, and so you miss out. We all do this. It becomes almost a full-time job to follow the sport you love. But there is a solution. The emailer Best of Cricket can tell you what the main stories are and the best articles every single day. And when they can't find them, they even write their own. Now, instead of trudging through Twitter or Blue Sky, you can just wait for the Best of Cricket to email or WhatsApp the greatest cricket stories straight to you. Subscribe to Best of Cricket today. Welcome back. Let's get into some of the super chats and a couple of other questions as well. Sono says, any thoughts on the Ireland Zimbabwe test? I watched a bit of it. I probably watched about a day and a half. I don't know if I have anything massive. I think Zimbabwe's interesting side in that their new ball bowling can do anything. And then afterwards, they just don't have the ability to pull teams back. I thought Ireland did some very, very, I thought Ireland took advantage of a couple of moments, but Ireland again is a team that doesn't really have a killer punch. So was it it was Blessing Mazarambani, but who was he batting with? The other guy, when they put on that huge last week of partnership, and it was like, they just don't have weapons. And so they can put themselves in good positions, but they let teams back in. And that's what happens. Zimbabwe just kept coming back, right, until they almost stole a game. So good on Zimbabwe. I think they've played some good cricket. I've watched quite a bit of their cricket recently. I think they've played some good cricket. They've got some good cricketers. It just doesn't quite gel perfectly together at all times. Genius says, also deep dived into the NBA after last week, into The Athletic and with JJ Redick's podcast with LeBron and Old Man in the Three. So much fun. Makes me wonder why cricket can't have this. Cricket can have this. There is firstly, The Athletic should have come to cricket. They made a mistake. And now they're in a position where I don't even know if it, you know, with the New York Times thing, I don't even know what the future of The Athletic is. But they made a mistake not coming into cricket. That's certainly what if you want to go on Substack, I've written a piece all about, I think if you put in Jared Kimber, Substack, The Athletic, you'll come up with a piece that I've written about it. cricket should definitely have a model like that. You know, I've talked to the JJ Redick podcast was one of the podcasts that I talked to when I was talking to some senior players, you know, famous international players about having proper podcasts, having an editorial department working with you, having a co-host who does all the work, you know, getting it turned around for short videos and all these sorts of things. And if there's any former players watching this, I've got the business model. I just need the people to do it. It's very repeatable. And you could do that quite easily. Obviously, at night when we had 99.94, we had Mitchell Johnson's podcast, which was slightly different because of what he was trying to do. But if you're a player towards the end of their career, which is, I think, the best time to start it, you can definitely put something together. There should be a podcast network. There should be an athletic model. There should be far more and better cricket coverage. And we're, as cricket fans, we don't have as great a coverage as we should. Substack's starting to be interesting, but the problem with Substack is, if you want to follow Kartikeya or Cricket et al. Or Manthorpe or, you know, all these different people, you know, myself, CS, if you pay everyone, you kind of end up like it costs you quite a bit. It shouldn't have to cost you that much. There should just be, we should all be under the one umbrella, but it's not quite there yet. In continuation to my question on Substack, is it fair to say in all formats that Dravid is better all time than Sunil and Kohli, or do you disagree? All formats, I would have Kohli ahead of Dravid. All formats, Dravid versus Gavaskar, I'd have to go through their one day records and have a look to be able to look at that. But yeah, if you're looking at all formats, I would have Kohli above those two pretty automatically. How similar are Kohli and Sunny? They're both mammals from India, males. No, they're very different kinds of players. I think Kohli's a fantastic player of high-end pace. I think Gavaskar was probably arguably the greatest player of spin we've ever seen in Test cricket. So instantly very different kinds of players. Gavaskar is more in that sort of Kane Williamson mold of waiting for the ball to come to him, and Kohli's more in that Ponting mode of going out and hitting it. So very different. Ikant says, who are your favorite non-sport YouTubers? I don't know if I have any. I did for a while, especially when I was trying to work out, you know, how to make our video essays better. I did follow some. I think there was a guy that did something on, I think it was on airlines. Maybe it was on planes that I remember watching quite a bit of, but I couldn't even tell you who he was. I don't spend a lot of time on YouTube. Oh, there is a guy I really like. In fact, there's a couple of guys. I don't know if you call them YouTubers, but I know they're cross-post. And so they might count as YouTubers. One is an English guy who does a podcast or a show called Scroll Deep, where he talks about internet nonsense. And as someone who's grown up with internet nonsense, there's no way I could ever keep up with it anymore. And his show is very good at explaining all these different concepts and things that, you know, as a dad is quite handy, but also I'm fascinated by all that sort of stuff because I was there when the internet started, and to watch it grow and evolve is really good. There's another guy, I think it's an American guy who does, he does the Museum of Twitter. I want to say, again, I don't know if that's on, I know he does that on, I'm trying to see who I'm following on TikTok. I know he does that there. On TikTok, but I think he might have it in other places. I'm just trying to see if there's anyone else in here that I probably that from a YouTubing. There's a music guy called Needle Talk that I've seen. There's a couple of movie people that I have followed, but I can't tell any names. So yeah, I think that's it from the ones that I'm sure there's more, but yeah, there you go. More TikTok than YouTube. Shrikant says, how would you compare Mark Waugh with VVS Laxman? And who would you rate higher as a test bat? VVS has high average, but Waugh has no weak spots behind Sri Lanka. It's a really fascinating one. We talked to Mark Waugh quite a bit for our book, and the more research I did on him, the more I realized that he's probably not a top 50 great batter of all time, but he was a great batter, right? So he's probably, again, in that weird 50 to 75 mark. Him and David Boone are quite interesting because they were so reliable for their teams. And their teams were really, really good. And yet, because they didn't end up with a high average, they've kind of been pushed down a little bit. I think the difference between VVS and Mark Waugh is that when VVS was on top, he just kept going, right? Whereas I think if you look at Mark Waugh, and he was really honest about this when we were chatting about it, he just got bored. And I think VVS's issue is that he got bored waiting to bat, especially behind guys who'd all made runs, and he didn't feel the inspiration. Whereas I think Mark Waugh would feel bored during his innings. I've done my job. We're 250 for two. Now I'm going to just try and hit some fours and sixes, or I'm going to, you know, chip a couple and head off. And that is a skill that, and both of them, sometimes you have to bat down the order and sometimes you have to keep batting on. And so I think you have to mark them down for that. But you also have to understand that a normal player with an average of 42 or 44 isn't anywhere near Mark Waugh or VVS Laxman's level. Like, what would Faf du Plessis average? Somewhere around that? Faf was a really good, solid test batter. He isn't Mark Waugh or VVS Laxman. He's not even close to those two, right? So I think you need to keep that in mind when you're talking about players like that. Who would I rate higher? I suppose, and I'd have to go back, maybe Varun's probably quickly looking this up. I wonder if VVS, a part of his runs is in the 2000s when the bat wickets were a bit flatter, whereas Mark Waugh had basically was probably done by the time the wickets got flatter, would be my guess. So Mark Waugh probably had to play in more spicier wickets consistently. So Mark Waugh is at 1.14 and VVS is at 1.08. I think that's kind of how I would rate them. We looked at VVS more for the book than we did at Mark Waugh. But part of that is because Mark Waugh didn't go on to dominate and get those. Like with VVS, I think you have, you know, 2-3, whatever it is, innings that are probably in the top 50 best innings ever played, right? The one innings I can think of Mark Waugh's is, I think it was Port Elizabeth when he makes 100 in Australia in the fourth innings, I want to say. It was definitely in South Africa. I don't know if that goes down as one of the greatest innings of all time, but I remember that as a fantastic innings from Mark Waugh, that whereas most of his other innings, he would make 100 and he would kind of change the direction of the game, but then his brother would make 100 later, or Alan Border would make 100 later, or Adam Gilchrist would come. Do you know what I mean? And so you don't remember them in the same way. Whereas in VVS Laxman's case, he just continues to bat, right? Like he continued to go all the way through. So I do think there's some issues with that. But it's why these things are so tough. And Mark Waugh was probably one of the players that I was looking at as someone who was legitimately a player whose average didn't quite. So I would probably have Mark Waugh, VVS Laxman, Aravinda De Silva. I'm trying to think of some others. Players who I think we know are better than what their overall averages are and where they've ended up. But at the same time, I don't know if that overcomes the fact that other players just made more runs than them consistently. So the test match I'm looking for is Australia was chasing 270. In a low scoring game. So no one had scored over 209 runs in the game at this stage. And Australia were chasing 270. And second top score for Australia was Matthew Elliott with 44. And Mark Waugh made 118. That was probably the best I ever saw him bat. And it was, but again, classic Mark Waugh. He goes out just before the end of the game, when he doesn't get his victory shot. And again, those test matches, in those days, people didn't, especially in Australia, didn't watch traveling, touring games as much as they do now. Cable TV wasn't that big. So that for me was just a phenomenal innings. And I remember that really, really well. And, whereas VVS has a bunch of those. So again, it just depends on where you come in. But yeah, him, Aravinda, VVS, Gower maybe is another one that you put up on there. I think Gower's record is actually really good, but again, it probably doesn't average quite the average that you would need it to be. Maybe not Martin Crowe, he's probably seen as a little bit higher than them, but David Boone would be another one. Trying to think of people like, would you have someone like Roy Fredericks in that perhaps? What was his average? Yeah, again, 42. Navjot Sidhu might be another player. These guys are probably had either skills or individual batting talent overall that was maybe top 50 of all time, but they didn't make runs as consistently as other great batters. And so it's where you kind of weigh them at the end. And I think that's probably, it's just how it is. But they're all greats for their teams. Although, you know, in some cases, they're not remembered at the level they should have been. But, you know, maybe one of the best ones of this is, oh my God, I've just forgotten his name. Hanif Muhammad. Hanif Muhammad might be the poster boy of this kind of player, where you can't do what Hanif Muhammad did without being a great batter. But you go back and you look at his overall record and you're like, it's not quite at the level that you would want it to be. Max says, are the bin tip pitches, I like bin tip because that means they're rubbish twice, being produced in Shield cricket affecting the batters? The pitch between South Africa and Tasmania, some of the wickets. What was the one last week where it was over in like an hour? Yes, they are affecting the batters. I've talked about this a lot. I think one reason that Australia has had a great run of test batters, other than talent and conditions and not having walls and all these sorts of things outdoor, is that the batting wickets are so good that you get used to trusting the ball. And at test level, generally you can trust the bounce and the sideways movement a little bit more than you can at first class level. And it's always set Australia up. There's confidence as well. You're used to making runs, whereas a lot of players who grow up in other locations, they're not used to making runs on the same level that Australian and India is one of the other great places, right, for that. So the talent plays a big part, but the pitches play a big part. New Zealand made their pitches more solid so that their batters get used to making runs, feel confident and trust the ball coming to them, and that their bowlers are used to being able to manufacture wickets for them. That's what Sheffield Shield cricket used to be. It's not like that anymore. So I think it is a problem. And Arco says, what's the story on Catholic versus Protestant conflict in Australian cricket? How did it shape cricket in the long run? I don't think there's ever been a book written on this or a long form article. Gideon might be the one, if anyone's ever done it. It was probably seen as too contentious back in the day to talk too much about. And I'm not an expert in Catholicism, or I'm an atheist. So they're all Catholics. They're all Christians to me. So, if some of you slightly change your view on what the batting order is between God, the Holy Spirit, and Jesus is, I don't understand all those sorts of things. I never went to church, and it just wasn't part of my upbringing at all. But there were Protestant players and there were Catholic players, and I think it's really post-war this becomes a bit of an issue, post-World War II, when it sort of starts, I think, around that point. But it might have been bubbling up even in the 1930s as well, but I don't know if the issues were as big. But I suppose it's no different than, changing rooms always sort of separate, right? One way or another, you have was it the 90s in Australia, they had the Julios and the nerds. So the loud players and the quieter players, right? The partiers and the non-partiers. You always have those things, but it was a divide that caused issues within Australian cricket because both sides felt like there was, like, the other side was taking the piss at times. But I don't know the full details. I just know it's a thing. And, I think O'Reilly and Bradman never really had a great relationship. And O'Reilly, as you might have guessed, was Catholic and Bradman was Protestant. How much it actually affected things, I don't know. But there were big schisms between the teams. But it's worse. The reason I bring it up so much is they still won. And those things always happen. And people don't like to admit that they happen. But it's very rare to have a team like the Dutch where everyone sort of is together and all eats breakfast together and gets along. I worked with Scotland, and there were clear delineations between different groups within that change room. And, same when I was at St. Lucia, and same when I've played club cricket, right? Like, it's the same things happen again and again, and some teams can get over it and some teams can't. And sometimes it has long, long effects. That one was, I think, it probably almost affected, in the case of O'Reilly and Bradman, I almost think it affected cricket longer because they continued in that, whatever you want to call it, that mentality, that mindset after. So it wasn't like it finished and then everyone just got along happily ever after again. It seemed to me, from the outside anyway, that it was something that affected the way those two commented. And it wasn't just those two, but my understanding is those were the two main voices in it. That it affected things for a long period of time. But, you know, if you go back, another good one would be the Afrikaners and the white English players in South African team. You know, you have another perfect situation. You then have geographical things like, you know, there are times within Australian cricket where Victoria has the power or New South Wales has the power and that causes problems. You have North and South divide in English cricket. You have North and South divide in Indian cricket. You have Mumbai versus everyone else. You have, you know, the Sri Lankan schools versus kids who don't come from Sri Lankans. The reason I use it is because that was the Invincibles team and they had that issue and it's been going on ever since. Like, this has always been a thing within cricket, right? That we have these divisions and it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't still play good sport. Also, you have to understand how to handle them. These aren't new that we see them now. Anyway, that's it for me here on the Wagon Wheel. Thank you, everyone. We are going to be, we're not going to do like a full-on scoreboard after every Champions Trophy game, but we will probably do something for most games. So if you stick on this channel and you press the subscribe button and the bell icon and all those different things that you need, we should be going live after a lot of Champions Trophy games. We'll still be making videos on the other channel as well. There's a really good video today, actually, about the 2004 Champions Trophy final, which if you've never seen it, it's a fascinating game to go back and have a look at. Definitely worth checking out that one. But we'll be doing lots of stuff all the way through the tournament on this channel and on the main channel as well. So come on board and we will see you again for more of Wagon Wheels and more of scoreboards and more of everything.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make any content, Minbo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips. Try Minbo.pro now.